Hello and welcome to Irish Pregnancy and Birth with me, Carolyn Coughlin. I'm a self-employed community midwife working in the Dublin Midleinster area. The mission of this podcast is to empower pregnant women with the most up-to-date information on all things pregnancy and birth by interviewing maternity healthcare professionals on a different topic every episode. For our third episode, we are incredibly lucky to have with us Patricia Hughes. Patricia is Associate Professor of the Nursing and Midwifery in Trinity College, Dublin, and has over 30 years of clinical and managerial experience from her work in Ireland, the UK and New Zealand, where she has led on a range of innovative services development, including the provision of the Domino Community Midwife Service and the water birth facility in the Coombe Hospital. She has recently founded Nursing and Midwifery Expertise, which provides midwifery and nursing expertise in quality improvement, risk management, and service innovation. Today, we'll be talking about informed consent and what choices have women in relation to how and where and when they give birth. Patricia, you're very welcome to the show.
Thanks, Carolyn. Nice to talk to you today.
Well, I'd really like to talk to you today about informed consent and how important it is for women when accessing the maternity services. Before we get into the details, can you give our listeners a brief definition of informed consent and how it relates to pregnancy and birth?
Well, I suppose for me, informed consent is giving your consent freely and having sufficient information on which to make your decision. Having the ability to understand that information and the context in which it's given, and that consent would be freely given and on the basis that it can be withdrawn or retracted at a given point in time. So I think each of those would, those parameters would be important in terms of informed consent. Okay. It's ethical, it's good practice.
Yeah, great. So obviously women should be able to trust the maternity service providers that they're doing the right thing. But there are many times when women might want to resist the pressure of hospitals. Can you give examples of what women might this be appropriate? You know, when it might be appropriate to resist the pressures of hospitals?
Well, I suppose hospitals are very busy places with lots of people, and there isn't always time for the service user to form a trusting relationship with the staff member or the healthcare provider in advance. And this can be challenging, I think, for service users and receivers of a service, and also for the healthcare professional. So there's certainly for the healthcare professional, you have to aim to ensure that your systems are based on evidence and that they are communicated clearly as much as possible in advance to any potential service users. However, I think if I bring it to the context of pregnancy and maternity care, we're probably fortunate in many ways in that you have usually about 6 to 7 or 8 months to form that trusting relationship with your caregivers. It's different, we'll say, to a person who's never been in hospital before and presents with stroke-like symptoms. That's a different context. Mm-hmm. But in general, many or most women are articulate or speak the language or have a good means of communication and can engage over time with their health service providers. They can also find out a lot of information about the service in advance. But it is a responsibility on the healthcare professionals to make sure that that information is out there in a format that's comprehensible by people who have maybe language needs, literacy needs, who may be deaf or who may be blind, and also for people, you know, minors or people under the ages of 16 in particular, where there might be other consent issues that are tied up with the legal framework. So in terms of what can be resisted, unfortunately, in our health services, not just in Ireland, but all over the world, we've lots of protocols and they are supposed to be evidence-based, but sometimes in the speed of offering and trying to provide a health service that might be understaffed, that might be underfunded to some extent, we can often offer services as a blanket protocol. And that doesn't suit everybody, and it may not be right for everybody. And I suppose I'm thinking really of interventions like continuous CTG monitoring, which is widely accepted and widely used as almost a blanket practice. But there is no evidence to support same. And we're often not good at communicating that to women in advance, because it's easier for us to monitor everybody all of the time, or so we seem to think in our health services. And sometimes when women find out that it isn't actually evidence-based, and it may mean there's some limitations on their mobility during labor, and that can in fact hamper the normal physiological process of labor, Then women might ask about it and may also wish to decline that. And if we haven't conveyed that information in that format and in that context in advance, a woman declining a practice that we've advocated without giving sufficient content to it can seem like a challenge to our knowledge and expertise, and that's challenging. So it is really important for us as healthcare professionals to put it out there what is evidence-based and what might be suitable or what might be indicated for women in certain categories, but also ensuring that the woman knows that it is her right to decline should she so wish. But it is important for us to make sure that we've given the information that's comprehensive and comprehensible to the woman, whatever her circumstances are. And I'm not saying that is easy. It is challenging in our health services. But I think there's a lot that can be done in advance that can make this a lot easier for women and their families, and a lot easier for the healthcare professionals with a little bit of effort.
Absolutely. And we'll be talking later in the show to Declan Devan in another episode about CTGs and about CTGs. But that's very interesting that you brought all that up. So when booking women for home birth, I always ask about their previous birth stories. Generally, I hear of interventions given without informed consent. What do you think might be the explanation for this? And I suppose you've mentioned that briefly with regards to hospitals being quite a busy place. And perhaps not having the time maybe to take to fully inform the women about a particular intervention. Is there anything, Carolyn, else to add to that?
Yeah, Carolyn, I feel strongly about this. And, you know, having spent over 30 years in health services and public health services, and obviously with some private and semi-private components as well, it is a huge problem. Whereby we do not provide sufficient continuity of care. And I think we make our jobs a lot more difficult as a result. So, for instance, and I have observed this in my posts, but in some of the larger hospitals, and even in some of the smaller ones, if you take it that a woman books to her antenatal clinic at about 12 weeks pregnant, let's say 12, might be later, might be a lot earlier as well, she can often see between her 6 to 8 antenatal visits, her 6 to 12 hour labor, and her 2 to 5 day postnatal visit, anything up to around 36 midwives. And there are many times, there are many midwives she'll never see more than once. And I think that this is a significant problem in our health service in Ireland. I have seen a better application of the continuity of care in the UK model and in the New Zealand model where I've worked previously. It's not perfect in either country, and each country has its own challenges. But the continuity of care model, they get right more of the time. I'm not saying they see the same midwife all of throughout the whole episode of care. They don't, and maybe that's not appropriate either. There is a benefit in seeing, you know, different people, but not a huge amount. And certainly, it's very difficult to convey your story to 36 people. And that's kind of an average. It might be a little bit less than that. But remember, if the woman has any complications, either during her antenatal labour or postnatal period, it could actually be a lot more. She could also see an awful lot more healthcare professionals in terms of doctors as well. And we don't get the continuity very well either when I look at the medical staff. And I suppose in my recent posts as, we'll say, the maternity service manager in Cavan, where I was for 7 years, and then in Cork and in the Coombe, where I was director of midwifery and nursing for over 11 years between those two hospitals, a lot of my work would involve reviewing complaints and reviewing incidents. And I was always struck by how many different names were in the sets of notes. So I do think continuity of care and communication, I mean, are huge challenges. And, you know, when I go back to my midwifery student days and we were introduced into the confidential inquiry into maternal deaths, and I follow those every triennium with eagle eyes, communication is there every single time. And so it is exceedingly more difficult when you add more people into the pot. And so if a woman has a set of, you know, requests, it's not really possible for her to convey that 36 different times or however many. But if she gets to know a midwife or know her doctor or whatever, it's a lot easier. And I've certainly been in a situation as a midwife myself where you'd see a woman back for her second and subsequent pregnancy. But even during the episode of care, you recall what happened the last time, you recall her context. And so you can give much better quality of care in the same period of time because you're familiar with the woman. And we haven't got that yet in Ireland. Certainly the National Maternity Strategy with its recommendations to have the specialist, the assisted and supported care models in place is well on its way to improving continuity of care. But even within those three models, there is a big effort needed to look at continuity of care. And I think if that comes in, it will certainly enhance communication and enhance consent. If I can give a little example, I looked after a woman who was having home birth many years ago. In fact, I saw a little thank you card from her the other day and I realized that the baby would now be 26 years old. But she was a woman that I'd seen once or twice maybe during her antenatal period. But I was called for her home birth. I didn't have a lot of contact with her. And there were vulnerabilities in the situation, so there was quite a lot of, there was a need for enhanced social support around her. She was a single mother with two small children. She had two born before arrivals before, and this time she was desperate to avoid a BBA. And so she wanted to have a home birth. So instead of her having to move and her children being put into emergency care, she wanted the services to come to her. And so there had been a lot of consultation and communication around it and it was agreed that we would provide her with a home birth. So we went out, I was the midwife to arrive first on the scene. And in fact, she gave birth very quickly. And I assumed wrongly that she was going to breastfeed. And when I passed the baby up to her to be able to provide skin to skin and talked about breastfeeding, she announced to me quite suddenly that she wasn't going to be breastfeeding. And I was taken aback by it. And I thought, I knew this woman, I'd met her twice, but I hadn't worked that out. And that was kind of a major lack I felt for me, not knowing that and not having got that information, although we had worked closely with her to ensure that we could provide what she needed. It all worked out. It was fine in the end. It required me to set up a sterilizer and sterilize some bottles and make up the feeds for 24 hours, which we did. But I just think of that case when I think of if you have 36 midwives. I had some inkling as to that woman's situation. I hadn't got all the information after two visits, and I should have had because, you know, your intention to feed is fairly basic. I hadn't got it. And it was something I made sure I didn't get caught with again. But I think continuity of care is really important.
Yeah, it's so important. And it's that mutual trust as well that you build up with the woman.
Absolutely, yeah.
So there's an acronym sometimes taught in antenatal classes called BRAINS, B-R-A-I-N.
Yes.
It is a mnemonic, sorry, to help women respond to suggestions to interventions. Have you come across it before?
I have, but don't ask me to say what BRAIN is at the moment, but I know it's benefits, risks, and so it goes on. And it's a lovely acronym to help and guide women to ask the questions. And I am very mindful of the fact that when you're the service, the person receiving the service, no matter how articulate, well-informed, no matter what your job is in your other life, it is a very, very difficult to ask questions about your own health. And I am a great believer in people who can advocate for you, especially when you're in labor or if you're otherwise, preoccupied. Because often, and I've seen it with my own family members, and I've seen it even with myself, if I've accompanied a family member, sometimes it's difficult to remember all the questions you went in to ask. And the more difficult the situation, the more difficult it is to ask the questions. So if you feel that you're questioning a practice that seems to everybody else to be acceptable, but you're not feeling comfortable about it, it makes it difficult to ask those questions. It also makes it difficult to ask questions if you have a condition, we'll say, you know, a life-threatening condition or a condition that has any concerns around it, it's difficult to ask questions. So I am a great believer in using that acronym like BRAIN, but also writing down your questions in advance and bringing somebody with you to have with you. Because sometimes even if you have all the questions written down, you get to question 5 and then you forget question 6 and you come out and you say, I never got to ask my last question. So I think it again behoves us as healthcare professionals to give adequate time, make sure the environment is conducive to the woman and her partner to ask the questions. And before they go, to always ask, have you asked everything you wanted to ask? And should there be more questions when you go home, this is how you can come back to me or get those questions answered. And important that there's written information for women on the subjects that they ask about. So if it's a meeting with a healthcare professional, either there's a leaflet to complement that conversation, if it's a consent around a vaginal birth after cesarean section or an external cephalic version. It is really important to have well structured and clear and concise information leaflets for women. But if it's a meeting around a complaint, it's important also to follow it up with written feedback in terms of the responses given to the parents.
So it's only 50 years or so that hospital births have become the norm. Before that time, most women birthed in home or in nursing homes. What are some of the advantages and disadvantages of the shift to hospital births? And what effect, if any, has it had on informed consent?
Well, I undertook my midwifery training in the late 80s, and I did my midwifery training in the UK, and the shift had already occurred in Ireland and England at that stage. I was fortunate to see a small number of home births as a midwifery student, and the contrast was fairly significant. When you go into somebody's house, you're a guest in their house, and you behave as a guest. The dynamic is completely different when a woman comes to the hospital, because that's often owned, that space is often owned by the healthcare professional. And you know, I remember, I think it was Sheila Hunt came to us to a conference in the Coombe many years ago and talked about notices. And, you know, if you go into a hospital, it's do not enter, no visitors here, nobody allowed in the kitchen. There's lots of no's and do's and don'ts. And she contrasted that with the hotel and said, how come in a hotel we don't have all those signs telling people that they don't do this and don't do that and don't. It's a hospitality service, and it, yet people don't wander into the kitchen in the hotels, and they don't make themselves cups of tea down in the main service area. So why do we feel the need to do it in hospital? And I don't really know why, but you know, there's no doubt about it. Our hospitals are full of notices. And even recently, I saw a podcast of a hospital during the COVID, which we're still going through, unfortunately. But it was in the middle of the COVID pandemic. And it followed, it was a virtual tour of a certain hospital. And there was the healthcare professional was taking the camera crew through the environment to show them. But each door they pushed through, the door was littered with signs. And I know myself, no, but I don't read those signs. Sometimes it's impossible to see what they're there. And it might be about, you know, press the green buzzer on the right to get entry. But, you know, you don't see those. So so going back to the hospital is different. You do feel if you're a service user, I think that you're in somebody else's space. And so that dynamic, that shift is there. And it's the direct opposite in a home birth situation or in a situation where you're doing a home booking. And so that's fairly significant in terms of your ability to ask questions and engage. And also when you're in the hospital, you're conscious that the staff are being shared amongst many other people. So you can't trust that you've got enough time with them. Now, you may not have any more time in the home, but it feels different. So for instance, I would say if I was doing a booking history of a woman in a home and it took 30 or 40 minutes, and it took 30 or 40 minutes in the hospital, the dynamics are still different in the hospital. I might take a phone call, somebody might knock on the door. I might be the one that would be disturbed, whereas in the home, that's less likely to happen. And I think that dynamic casts a certain sense around the relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So Irish maternity hospitals tend to favour an active management approach. What is active management, and how might this approach impact on a woman's informed consent?
Well, I think the terms active management were really written up by the previous masters of the National Maternity Hospital. And it was a set of interventions designed to identify women in labour and to identify if problems were occurring and to identify those early on and to intervene as was deemed appropriate. It was also in the context of where women had many children or there was a high number of births in the hospital and there were limited, I suppose, facilities in which to do so. However, the whole world uses some element of active management. Anywhere I've worked, I've seen it. I've visited friends in Canada and visited the local maternity hospitals, active management is there. I have spent some time in Bethlehem and in the West Bank in Palestine. There's active management there. I've worked in New Zealand. I've worked in several hospitals in England and several hospitals in Ireland, and active management is there. Maybe not in the truest form as written up by the National Maternity Hospital, but elements of it. And I suppose there are advantages and benefits to it in certain circumstances. However, there isn't evidence there to say that that is the appropriate, that these are appropriate set of interventions for every woman in labour. And that is what we have to be careful about.
Yeah. And I guess then what options do women have nowadays for where they might give birth in Ireland?
Well, I think there are some options there. There aren't a lot of options, but there are some options. But the bigger problem is that even if the options are there, they're not always communicated to women, and the women don't often know what they are. So, for instance, Women can choose to have a home birth. However, they need to fulfill certain criteria to do that, generally speaking. And they can get a home birth through the HSE via a subcontracted self-employed community midwife. I know, Carolyn, you provide that service yourself. They can also access a home birth via a private company that's operating in Ireland at the moment, a group of private midwives. And I think they're indemnified by a UK body. So home birth is possible there, but not everybody knows about that. Then there's obviously hospital birth. And if you go to give birth in the hospital, you can go in as a public receiver of the health services, or you can go book private or semi-private care and accommodation. Now you can book directly with an obstetrician if you want to go privately and book as a private patient in the hospital, or you can book as a semi-private in terms of accommodation in some hospitals. The insurance status seems to be more widely advertised in Ireland than the options for care in terms of home birth, hospital, or midwifery led unit. We have two midwifery led units in Ireland, and they're based in Cavan and in Drogheda. They opened in 2004, so they're 16 years of age at the moment. One unit is used very widely and one unit is used less widely. And there will be apparently some local preferences for one or the other. And but those are evidence-based facilities, and they have proven themselves time and time again. And it would be good for them to be more widely used than they are. The National Maternity Strategy espouses setting up many more of those alongside midwifery-led units. And even though the National Maternity Strategy is now in its fifth of its 10-year strategy, none of them yet have been set up and none of them yet are at the planning stage. And that's disappointing. However, there are two there, and I would encourage that women who are in those vicinities would look at them. It's not for everybody, and women's choice is paramount in this. So obviously they have to meet certain eligibility criteria, but even if you meet certain eligibility criteria, a woman may choose one mode of care over the other for her own reasons, and that's absolutely to be respected. However, I know lots and lots of women who say, nobody ever told me about that option. I never knew about it. Why wasn't I told? And so that's the piece I think we have to be much better at here in Ireland, telling people what's out there. The HSE developed a book there in the last 2 years called mychild.ie. It's a website and there's a book on it. It gives some information about those options. But I would like to see it a lot more widely advertised. For instance, in Scotland, the chief midwifery officer there a number of years ago, they had set up something called KNCD, KCND, Keeping Childbirth Normal and Dynamic. And they had a whole pathway of care that enabled women to book directly with their midwife if they suspected being pregnant. It was widely advertised on the sides and backs of buses, in your local pharmacies, health centres, schools, everywhere. We need to take an approach like that here in Ireland. Midwifery is still a relatively poorly understood concept in Ireland compared to in other European and even international countries. And it is, although the Act changed, the Nurses Act changed in 2011 to become the Nurses and Midwives Act, there are still a lot of people who do not understand the difference between the professions and still mix both of those professions up, even though they're very separate and distinct professions, albeit regulated by the Nursing and Midwifery Board of Ireland. So I do think that as a country, we have a lot more to do to publicly educate ourselves about the difference in the professions and what each what the midwifery profession can offer to women during pregnancy, labour, birth and the postnatal period, and then to also know what options are available to women there, and that they have the, that it's their choice, and that they have the information on which to make their choice and make a valid choice for them.
Great, thank you for clearly laying out the different options available to women. So many midwives and researchers would favour an increase in home births and births in midwifery-led units, which you already discussed about. I guess you've talked about these a lot, but I guess if there's anything else, do you have any other opinion on home birth and midwifery-led units, or how could we progress in that area? I guess you talked about that already.
Yes. I feel strongly that, you know, any time I've asked or inquired about progress in terms of midwifery-led units, some senior advisors would often say, but we haven't got enough midwives to do what we're doing already. And we're training them, but they're leaving, they're going to other countries, and they're not coming back. And so I do think that there's a few issues at heart. I do think that we absolutely need to carry out an urgent but comprehensive workforce planning exercise. And this too was one of the work streams of the National Maternity Strategy. And I understand that it was due to have been completed maybe by 2018, 2019. And to date, that hasn't yet been undertaken. And so that does need to be undertaken, because we've got to project how many midwives we need and to be able to staff those areas. I think if we get continuity of care right, we'll start improving communication and we'll start improving choices, a bit, access to choice. And we'll be ensuring that women have more information on which to make the choices. I think that if midwives are leaving, yes, they do leave. And they leave because they say they want to practice midwifery the way they understood midwifery was provided. And so often, candidates come into midwifery having read up a lot about it, knowing a little bit about it, have seen or heard how it operates, and then being disappointed or confused around the role that they have been allowed to follow in Ireland, and that it hasn't provided them with the scope to practice as they thought that a midwife would or should be able. And so they feel quite constrained. And so they want to experience working as a midwife in a country which understands and enables the fulfillment of the role. And so I think we have to get that right. But I do understand, and I've been in the situation many times where, you know, it has felt, and it is more than a feeling, it has been short-staffed. And so when you're that short-staffed, it's difficult to say, right, let's sort out continuity of care. All of these work streams need to somehow happen in concert with each other. So we do need to be looking at continuity of care. We do need to be looking at choice and communication. We need to be looking at workforce planning and numbers, and working to see how we can retain our midwives in Ireland, being able to work in these various pathways of care and being able to provide choice and continuity to women.
So women arrive in hospitals with a plan and a vision on how they would like to give birth. Very often this plan is quickly abandoned. Sometimes this is because circumstances require a different approach, but often it is because women get caught up in the hospital system, which doesn't tend to have much time for a woman's birth plan. With very little continuity of care and the caseload most hospitals are dealing with, this is understandable. But it does leave a massive problem in relation to informed consent, in relation to the way a woman births in a hospital setting. What recommendations, if any, would you have to a woman who has a definite vision of how they want to birth and how they might have their plan taken more seriously in a hospital setting?
I've come across a number of situations, one whereby I've met with a woman who was distraught because her birth plan, which was entirely reasonable, was discounted by, you know, healthcare professionals on the first approach. Or she was told to tone it down or to modify it somewhat because certain people wouldn't necessarily be happy with it. And this is so wrong. This shouldn't be happening in our health service. I've also seen cases whereby people have, women have come in with birth plans whereby the staff have really jumped over, walked over hot coals to make sure that her options and her choices and her decisions were met. Really went to great lengths to do so. And so I do think it's possible, and it is happening and it has happened. But equally, the other way is happening and has happened. And that's not good for anybody. It's not good for the woman. It's not good for her relationship with her healthcare providers. It's not good for the hospital and its relationship with women and their families. And whereby a woman isn't heard and seriously, her request seriously taken on board and worked through in a respectful and a mutually trustful environment, it usually ends up with discontent on both parties and distrust at the very least. And very often a woman is traumatized afterwards and finds it very difficult to reconcile with why she's been handled or treated in this way. And that shouldn't be happening. Really, it shouldn't. I've heard things like, well, the midwives aren't happy or the doctors aren't happy. It's not up to us to be happy. It is up to us to ensure that the woman is happy with her choices and her decisions. And to do that, we must give her the information in a non-judgmental way and provide her with all of the information and to be respectful and trustworthy with her and to assist her in whatever way we can. I understand when people are short-staffed, sometimes the priority seems to be something else and things can get overlooked. But I do think that we need to do more in our Irish health services towards working towards a system, a place whereby women can have easy access throughout their pregnancy, labour and postnatal period to high quality information that's non-judgmental, non-biased, that it's not because midwife X is on or Dr. Y is on that she's getting something that she asked for or that she's not getting something that she asked for. There should be a standard of care to which we're all working hard to achieve. And I do think that we have some work to do in that. In terms of women, what can they do? I would suggest that if women have, where they feel they want to, I suggest that women should seek the information around certain choices and decisions that they want to make, you know, when they can in pregnancy, as early as they can. To also ask their director of midwifery in writing if they can be provided with continuity of care. I do think that women have a lot more power than they think they have, but often we don't tell them that. And so it should be taken as granted that women will have continuity of care, but I'm afraid in Irish health services, we're not achieving that. Not even during labour are we achieving necessarily one-to-one care. Often you can see many, many midwives during your labour. Even if your labour is a relatively 68-hour labour, lots of women are seeing more than two or four midwives. So I do think that women can and should ask for continuity of care. They should ask for whatever birth plan that they wish to draft up. They should look to speak with a midwife as early as possible. So I'm saying don't wait until labour. But like if labour is the first time you come up with it, so be it, then you ask for it. But if you thought about it beforehand, ask as soon as you think about it and ask about those choices. Use the acronym like BRAIN to ask about interventions that are recommended and to have an advocate with you and to ensure that your advocate also is enabled to ask the questions that if you're in the throes of labour, that they're empowered to ask. And so continuity of care, early asking, writing a birth plan, having somebody to advocate for you and to ask for you, and also putting your requests, you know, often people will ask about it during labour. If somebody asks you to modify your birth plan or change wording, please look for more information. Look to speak to somebody more senior, because that in itself is not a wise move. And I would be concerned if that was the first line approach, but I have come across it, unfortunately. So I would say to women, if you're asked to change your birth plan after, because a midwife or a doctor may not like the way you've put that, ask to speak to somebody else, because it's important that we work together in an open and trustworthy environment, and your choices must be respected. And if your choices are maybe not possible, or you know, maybe there's evidence that would suggest an alternative, that can be conveyed to a woman without her having to be told to change her birth plan. So I think just that sort of not to be afraid to ask for to speak to a more senior person or another person if you're unhappy at the first joint. And for women, I would also say, and we say it as midwives all the time, trust your instinct. Your instinct rarely lets you down. So you often get a gut feeling about whether something is really wrong. And if it is, don't ignore that instinct. Follow it through. You may find that, you know, and talk to a number two or number three, that maybe things make more sense to you, and that's fine. But don't just accept it if it feels wrong. Ask to speak to somebody else and never be frightened in our maternity services.
That's so important, and that's what the I stands for in BRAINS, you know, so the benefit, risks, what are the alternatives to this intervention? What's your intuition telling you about it? And what would happen if we did nothing? And then Absolutely. And then I add in the S for smile, because you need to, you know, there's no point in meeting with, you know, real aggressive confrontation, because that's going to reduce your oxytocin level. So you want to keep the oxytocin flowing.
Absolutely. Yes.
So women, especially first time mothers, are often artificially induced for not going into labor within 2 weeks of their estimated due date. Induction of labour tends to be more painful and more problematic than natural labour. What is your opinion on due dates, and where does informed consent come in?
Well, look, I mean, there's two things here, and we have to be upfront about it. The due date is either calculated on your periods if you've, you know, a regular cycle and you're sure of your dates, and it's invariably, for most women in Ireland, confirmed by a scan if it's done between 11 and 13 weeks. And it sets a date of usually about 40 weeks of pregnancy. And we know from the evidence that perinatal mortality and morbidity issues increase after about 14 days after that estimated date of delivery. So most hospitals are generally okay with leaving someone for up to 14 days afterwards. It is a woman's choice whether she continues after that, and how we communicate that isn't always well done, because we're trying to get the balance right between ensuring that women understand that risk of increased morbidity and mortality after 14 days, and also ensuring that there is the facility in our hospital. So if we left everyone till 14 days, given that our induction lists are usually high and particularly in the larger hospitals, you could be booked for an induction, we'll say today, when you're 14 days. But the induction process may not kick in for a day or so. It may take 36, 48, 96 hours perhaps for it to evolve without any problem. So you could be giving birth on day 15, 16, 17. Or it could be that the day you come in for your induction at day 14, if we leave it to day 14, that there's been a surge that day in the number of women presenting, either in spontaneous labor or a surge in activity in terms of the number of emergencies. And so it may not be possible to tend to the induction of the labor for a woman that day. And so inadvertently, the hospital then may not be able to provide the induction of labor on the date in question. And so the hospital is working to prevent any risk to the woman by its inability to provide her with an induction by day 14. So you will see lots of women will get booked at around 10 days post the date. And that is for primarily for the reason to ensure that the hospital has the facilities and the ability to provide that woman's induction of labor before the critical period of day 14. And so I think if we're upfront about that, explain that to women, that that's why we're doing it at day 10, which could be day 11 or day 12. And it's not at all a strange phenomena for a woman to come into hospital and say, I'm in here since Tuesday. I was supposed to be induced on Tuesday, but it was very busy and they couldn't start me off to Wednesday evening or Thursday morning or whatever. But if we're upfront with the women about that, then the women can make the choice for themselves. And we tend to offer induction at day 10 because we gloss over it and say important for you to be delivered by day 14. And I'm not sure that we do that in sufficient detail. So I do think that, again, better communication around that and the aid of printed information leaflets in an understandable format, whether they're available online or whether it's in a paper copy at the hospital. These are important supports to communication. So induction, I understand like there's an evidence base for it. However, there are practical issues that come into play in hospitals that can prevent an induction being carried out on the day it was deemed necessary. And so often you will see, certainly, you know, we will see as healthcare professionals working in the hospital that you have an induction list and then you go through a prioritization of that induction list. So who's being induced because their baby is not growing well, or who's being induced simply because they've hit day 10, in which case the mother and baby is fine, so they could be left for another day or 2 days. And that happens in hospital. I don't think we ensure that women understand this. And sometimes you will have women in hospital and they will be frustrated and annoyed that they came in on Tuesday for an induction that hasn't started yet. And those are the reasons. And I think we can improve on our communication in those areas.
And I think it's important as well to be able to communicate to women that they can go beyond the 14-day period.
Absolutely, because there's a risk there, but not everybody. It won't affect everybody. We're not good at determining who it will affect and who it won't. So a woman has the right to make her own choice despite what evidence we provide. I agree.
Yeah. So another way women are put on the clock is by the expectation of progress in labour. But there's little agreement in practice regarding the diagnosis of labour and the correct rate of progression. What do you think about informed consent as regards to interventions based on failure to progress in labour?
Again, there's a mixed bag of stuff here. There are some cases whereby women progress at a faster rate and some of cases where women progress at a slower rate. And there are some women where there is a reason why the labour is not progressing. And those are the ones that we really want to be concerned about. We want to know Why is their labour not progressing? And is there some obstacle to that? And we go back to what we learned to student midwives, the three Ps. Is it a problem with the passengers, the passage, or the powers? So is the baby too big for the pelvis? Is the pelvis an odd shape, or has it been contracted due to injury? Or are the powers or the contractions, are they inefficient, or are they not strong enough? And so that's our modus operandi, is to keep a close eye on the three Ps and ensure that they're all fine. However, we use the words failure to progress, and as you've said, and there's a lot of attention recently in terms of the language we use in women's health, and it's not always useful or helpful language, and failure to progress falls into that category. And I think that we don't always identify in time the women who have problems with either of the three Ps. And in other cases, we provide interventions for so-called failure to progress without necessarily having very good evidence of it. And so you've come up there with the frequency of vaginal examinations and the diagnosis of labour. And we all know that the diagnosis of labour is kind of is hotly debated, and it can be viewed as subjective by some people. It used to be considered, well, if you're 3 centimetres dilated and your cervix is effacing and you're getting regular contractions, we're in labour. But if your cervix was 2 centimetres dilated and it was effacing and you're having regular contractions, you were not in labour. Why not? Or others thought that you had to be 4 or 5 centimetres or whatever. And the centimetres isn't an exact science. It's a subjective assessment carried out by many different practitioners in the dark, because you're doing an internal examination. And we all have our own inter-operator reliability issues and so on. The frequency of vaginal examinations is also a tricky one. And some people think that more vaginal examinations leads to better assessment, and that isn't always the case. And in my view, we do too many vaginal examinations in too many cases. And often, again, I go back to continuity of care. I have seen huge numbers of vaginal examinations being carried out by a wide variety of personnel. I mean, there'll be midwives or obstetricians, or they might be all midwives. But what I mean by that is that, you know, more than 2 different people could be doing your vaginal examinations. So if you don't have continuity of care and you see 4 midwives during your labour, and each one of the 4 does a vaginal examination, then you'd have to question how they really are monitoring progress in all elements. I also feel that with the advent of more continuous monitoring, there seems to be less emphasis on external signs of labour. And one of the things that I look at is how frequently midwives carry out abdominal palpations and assessment of descent of the presenting part. And this isn't always done by midwives. And I think that clues to our signs and symptoms of progress in labour are missed by not doing this examination. And people often go straight for an internal examination, a vaginal examination, to provide all the answers. And they've excluded many of the answers by not carrying out an abdominal palpation, by not observing the woman's ability to cope with her labour or her vital signs. And so I think these are, observation of the woman is key, and the external signs and symptoms are key. And there's a little too much emphasis in some cases on internal examinations with limited information and too frequent vaginal examinations. We do know that there's a risk of infection every time we do an internal examination. And although we try to keep this to be an aseptic procedure and, you know, a clean procedure, nevertheless, the movement of one's hand or fingers entering the vaginal canal is moving, movement of organisms from perhaps the exterior to the interior. And especially if a woman has ruptured membranes, we have to be conscious of the environment we provide for the woman. And I do think that a lot more external observation of the woman, assessment of her progress of labor from her vital signs, her ability to cope with labor, and her abdominal palpation are the main indicators of progress of labor. And vaginal examination is almost like a validation of that, but on its own, I don't think it gives us the picture of labor. And we often then say women have failed to progress in labor. And when they're not failing to progress at all, they're actually progressing okay. And certainly when we were setting up the midwifery led units in the Northeast, and we looked for the evidence for the frequency of vaginal examination, you know, I think the old adage that, you know, once you're in labor, you're expected to, your cervix to dilate at about a centimeter an hour. For the midwifery led units, we found the evidence was that a half a centimeter an hour was considered progress. So that's what the minimum progress in labor was set at for the women attending the midwifery led units in normal labor, where there are no complications with the mother or the baby. And that's still the case to this day. And as we know, the midwifery led units have proved their safety. So we have to ask, why are we still sticking to one centimetre per hour for every woman in every type of labour in our bigger, in our hospitals and our bigger labour and birth centres?
And I guess it's how often the vaginal examinations are offered as well. You know.
Exactly. I mean, and that's where I come into the too frequent. I mean, again, in the midwifery led unit, we found that the evidence supported roughly about every 4 hours. However, in most of our hospitals and centres, these examinations are often carried out as a routine every 2 hours. But actually, if you look at notes like I've looked at them, women are having even more examinations than that. And I would have to question that. So a woman in a 10-hour, 15-hour labour could have 10 or 12 examinations. And I would have to question that. And again, insufficient information. I was taught that you must always carry out an abdominal before you carry out your internal. And that was the standard we set for when we were designing the maternity and neonatal clinical management system. So for that electronic computer record that's in vogue, that's in place in several hospitals now, I think it's in Cork, the Hollis Street, the Rotunda, Kerry. The requirement is that you do your abdominal examination before you do your internal. But I expect there's ways around it if one wants to, but the days when people should be having 15 examinations are in that period of time, they don't make sense. And all they say is that the person doesn't really know what's happening, and they haven't assessed labor properly, and they haven't looked at the whole picture. I'm not saying don't do vaginal examinations. They are a necessary part of assessment of progress of labor for many women as well, but they are not the end all of monitoring of progress during labor. And I think we do need to look at the three P's much more carefully.
Okay, so in 2016, you founded Midwifery and Nursing Expertise. Can you tell me more about it and what led you to set it up?
Well, I'm a long time working in the health services, and I was primarily looking for a different way to work within maternity services in Ireland. And after being director of midwifery in one of the largest maternity hospitals in Europe, you know, you ask where next. And the options that were open to somebody in my situation where that you would leave maternity services if you wanted to go up the ladder any further. So there wasn't really anything that appealed to me. However, I wasn't yet retirement age, and I'm quite a bit away from it yet. So I looked to see what I could do in a different way. And there were a couple of options that were open to me, but I looked instead at self-employment and looked at that in terms of maintaining a work-life balance for myself at this stage in my career. And I also wanted to remain firmly rooted within the provision of maternity services in Ireland. So the business I founded, as you say, I founded to remain working in the services, to provide the skills and knowledge that I had gained over my 30 plus years in the health service, and to provide something back, and also to have a job that was fulfilling to me at this stage in my life. So the work I do primarily is I do a lot of risk reviews, I do a lot of reports into adverse incidents, but I also do project work around workforce planning and governance and standards, primarily within maternity care, but some also within nursing care in the related general nursing disciplines. So that's primarily what I do nowadays.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Patricia.
Thank you, Carolyn.
No, it's so grateful to have you on the show today. Is there anything else you'd like to add before I close?
No, I suppose I'm an active member of the Midwives Association of Ireland. This was a professional association set up a number of years ago to provide a venue and a place for midwives to express the professional voice of midwifery. We're all members of our various unions that provide our HR and IR voice, but we wanted to be able to provide a professional voice, a go-to association, whereby others could contact us for advice and information. And we produce position statements on various aspects of maternity care. So I'm an active member and elected chairperson at the moment of that association, although I am planning to hand over that role before the end of the year, please God.
Fantastic. Thank you
very much.
So it's been a really valuable chat, and for any women who are curious about their options in regards to where and how they might birth, for someone with many years of high-level experience in the field. The whole purpose of this podcast is to empower pregnant women with the most up-to-date information in all things pregnancy and birth, and there is nothing more empowering than becoming informed about your options. So I'm very grateful for you explaining some of these options around informed consent so clearly today. I've been your host and midwife, Carolyn Coughlin. I hope you enjoyed the show. We'll be back soon with interviews with Michelle O'Daunt, Jack Newman in the upcoming episode. So don't forget to subscribe now. You can contact the show at dublinhomebirth @gmail.com or dublinhomebirth.com. Thank you.
Thank you, Carolyn.